just introduced him, and the showrunner has always been involved in Silver. He ran Silver Department at Christie's in London before becoming curator of the Quality of Art at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. More recently, he was curator of the Gilbert Collection at Somerset House and consultant curator at the Victoria and Albert Museum. Publications include the National Trust Book of English Domestic Silver, and British and Continental Gold and Silver National Museum. He's a fellow of the Society of Antiquaries and the Warden of the Goldsmiths Company, and presently is chairman of the Silver Society. I'll pass the word to you then.
Thank you very much, Francesca, and thank you, Morris, for those kind words of introduction. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is, I have to say, an enormous pleasure to be here this evening, and I would like to thank very much the Fondazione Patrimonio Molti on behalf of my friends from the Silver Society of London for inviting us all to be with you today and for making us so welcome. So thank you. We're spending a week on your wonderful island, seeing many absolutely marvelous things and enjoying enormously the hospitality for which Malta is so justly famous. But we're on holiday. Malta is making us welcome, and it's also making us relaxed. So I thought that rather than a stultifyingly formal and overly serious lecture, I'd deliver one that will entertain you. Entertain you with some wonderful images and some good stories, and I'd leave the footnotes at home for another day. When I first met Maurice de Giorgio in March of this year, he kindly asked me if I would like to return at some stage to give a lecture on some aspect of silver that might relate to the collections at Palazzo Falzon. I hadn't yet visited the Palazzo at the time, but I promised to bear it in mind. When I got there, I was absolutely delighted by the richness of the collection, as I'm sure our Silver Society members will be when we visit Medina tomorrow. But as I looked around the displays in the dining room and elsewhere in the house, I noticed a small group of splendid, if rather eccentric, 19th century models of ships. And I realized that I'd found my subject. Malta is, after all, an island. Shipping has always been your lifeblood, and it put me in mind of a very special twist to the subject that I hope will stir your imagination. But there I'm getting a little ahead of myself. Ship models like this one were very popular in the late 19th century. They were a particular speciality of the firm of Ludwig Niersheimer and Company, a large manufacturer based at Hanau near Frankfurt, and that frankly churned out large quantities of decorative pieces in historic styles. In the case of these ship models, they were meant as elaborate table decorations, and with their funny little wheels, they could be pushed around the table to entertain the guests. You might think here that the historic references were restricted to the ship being based on an old-fashioned sailing vessel. But there you'd be quite wrong. For the whole idea of silver ships on dining tables has in fact a long history. Indeed, the other two ship models at Palazzo Falzon, even less like real ships, are pretty closely based on a type that was made in Germany in the early 17th century. These two extraordinary fantasies in the Victoria and Albert Museum were made in Regensburg and in Nuremberg around 1620, and they're almost dead ringers, I think you'll agree, for the ones in Medina. They're very elaborately made, richly worked on the hulls. Here we're looking at the one from Regensburg, and the deck and rigging are absolutely covered with figures of crew. There's even a little monkey you can see seated on the top of the poop deck on this one. But there's more to it than that. The Regensburg model is the more elaborate of the two, and you can in fact lift the whole of the superstructure off to reveal its other purpose. For it becomes a drinking cup. You suck through the prow of the boat, which is hollow and doubles as a drinking straw, as it were, and as the wine in the bowl gradually disappears, it reveals its final joke, the little lizard concealed in the centre. It is wonderful what you can do with the gizmos that PowerPoint presents you with. But in these elaborate toys had a much longer history even than that. And in fact, they can be traced back to the Middle Ages. They're generally agreed to have originated in France, and indeed the name by which they are known, nef, is the early French word for ship, and is connected with the English word nave, meaning the main body of a church, whose roof in the Middle Ages was made from curved wooden beams that resembled an upturned ship, such as this wonderful roof at Bury St. Edmunds in Suffolk. One of the earliest images we have of a nef, rather earlier than any surviving examples, appears in one of the sumptuous pages of the Très Riche Heure of the Duke de Berry, which was done in about 1410. You probably all know this image. It shows the Duke, brother of the King of France, dining in great magnificence. He's seated in state with rich tapestries on the wall behind him. The steward tests the wine to the left, and there's a heavily laden buffet of golden plate at the edge of the picture. At the table itself, the carver, a high-ranking nobleman rather than a servant, carves the meat for the Duke, while to his left is an impressive boat-shaped vessel which, like all the other plate on the table, is probably made of gold rather than silver gilt. It is, of course, a highly stylized boat, but recognizably boat-like even so, with its heraldic focussels fore and aft, and the impression of shields hanging along the sides, rather in the way one would imagine a Viking boat to be. But look at the boat a little more carefully, and you can see that it's being used to contain the Duke's drinking utensils. The round plates inside are clearly visible, and there are probably knives and spoons in there too. This seems, in fact, to have been the original purpose of the nef, though, like the ceremonial great salt in England, it was also a status symbol, and something which only the greatest personages could aspire to. Normally, you would expect only to find one nef on view, but occasionally, at a great meeting of monarchs, there might be multiple nefs, such as this slightly earlier depiction of a banquet for three kings. The Holy Roman Emperor Charles IV on the left, Charles V of France in the centre, and the Emperor's son Wenzel, King of Bohemia, on the right. Precedence was as important then as at any time, and it's perhaps not by chance that the King of Bohemia, younger and less important than the other two, has a slightly smaller nef. By the late Middle Ages, the fashion for nefs had spread across much of Europe, though, interestingly, it never really caught on in England. But even from this comparatively late period, much of our knowledge is from images rather than surviving objects. A page from the early 16th century Flemish Grimani breviary, which you can see on the screen here, is almost like a remake of the Très Riche Heure. It shows the nobleman seated as before, with the buffet to the left and dishes of food being brought in at the back. He has a sumptuous rock crystal cup to his right and a nef to his left. But in this case, there's no sign of its performing any practical role, and its sole purpose by now, this is 200 years after the Duke de Berry's illustration, its sole purpose now is perhaps just to be a handsome status symbol and a decoration. from Italy, where virtually no medieval secular silver survived at all, we have a remarkable drawing by the late 15th century artist Pisanello. You might take this just for a drawing of a ship, but it has no mast, its forecastle and poop seem to be overly decorated, and of course there's the dragon bearing it up. Taken together, all these points make it pretty certain that this is in fact a design for a goldsmith rather than a shipwright. And from Germany, we have a detail of a banquet of the Emperor Charles V, dating from around 1530. And here it is, this almost panoramic depiction of the event where the emperor dines in state, courtiers, soldiers, and servants abound and run around. But a major focus of the image is the great buffet on the right. It has five stages, groaning under the weight of large ceremonial drinking vessels. And at the center of the display is a nef in full sail. Again, a pretty clear indication that it has by now lost its former practical function and it is just an item of display. Until quite modern times, plate had always been vulnerable to the melting pot. Gold and silver, you must remember, were money. And when money was short, plate, including old and beautiful pieces, were melted down without sentimentality or hesitation. But to a degree, anyway, objects that belonged to the church were protected from this routine destruction, and a number of nef-like objects made for incense survive for this very reason. From England comes the very beautiful mid-14th century Ramsey Abbey incense boat, which is now in the Victoria and Albert Museum. And this survived the Reformation when so much early church plate was melted down because it was thrown into a lake, presumably deliberately rather than by accident, with the intention of it being recovered at a later date. It's a guess that it came from Ramsey, but probably right because of the punning ram's heads at each end. From Spain, we have an even more extraordinary late 15th century incense boat in Burgos Cathedral, which has a half-realistic hull, but rather fantastical belfry-like superstructures, less focusals, you might say, than faux belfries. The Ramsey and Burgos pieces were made for use in the Mass, but there's quite a different category of early silver in church ownership, and that is pieces of secular origin that were later given to the church, either as votive offerings or because they were converted into reliquaries. And some of the oldest nefs we know survive for that reason. One of the most precious is the nef of Anne of Brittany. It's made of gold, silver gilt, jasper, and enamel, and it belonged to Anne, consort of Louis XII of France, and it was made in about 1500. But whereas almost all the royal plate from that period has long since disappeared, this piece survives because it was given at an early date to Reims Cathedral, where it remains to this day. Perhaps at this time, or a little earlier, the nef was converted into a reliquary, commemorating St. Ursula and the 11,000 virgins. You will remember, of course, that St. Ursula was a Romano-British princess who set off to marry a Gaulish prince and took with her an entourage of 11,000 virgins. Having been miraculously saved from a storm during their crossing, she vowed to go on a pilgrimage, but was unfortunately captured by a pagan ruler and killed for her faith, along with all 11,000 of her long-suffering virgins. The 11 gold and enameled figures on the deck represent Ursula herself and a token group of the virgins, presumably, there are 10 of the virgins on deck, so presumably the other 10,990 are below deck. The figures on the deck are completely out of scale with the boat. And this old photograph of the forecastle shows one much smaller figure, which is perhaps the sole survivor of the original crew that populated the deck and that were removed when the piece was turned into a reliquary. Another, only marginally less glamorous, French nef survives also in the Victoria and Albert Museum and is known as the Burley nef. This was made in Paris in 1527, and it emerged from Burley House in Lincolnshire, in the Midlands of England, in the late 1950s. How it got there, nobody knows for sure, though Burley House was built by Lord Burley, Queen Elizabeth I's Secretary of State, and it's not inconceivable that it had at one time belonged to the great man himself. The nef is a fine piece, in very fine condition. Like so many, it's a fantasy. The Nautilus shell hull is carried by a mermaid. The deck and the rigging are populated with little figures of crewmen. But this nef has a different sort of function from the earlier ones and is, in fact, a salt cellar. And you can just see the salt dish in the poop deck in this, again, old black and white photograph. But the most intriguing feature of the nef is even more difficult to spot, and that is the two figures seated at the base of the main mast. There they are. They're playing a game of chess, you can probably see, and in fact they represent Tristan and Isolde, or Isolde if you prefer. The medieval romance tells us that they played chess to while away the journey from Ireland to Cornwall, and the fact that they're holding hands suggests that the love potion has started to work. Cue Wagner, finale of Act One. Well, the nef may have been a medieval idea, but it never truly went away in France, and it continues to lurk in the visual language right up to the Revolution and beyond. We see it in prints and drawings of the 16th century, such as these here. And we see it in prints of the 18th century, such as a design by Meissonier for a nef pour le roi. We can even see its echoes in an extraordinary creation of Sèvres porcelain called the Vaso à main. Even Napoleon, plunderer of Malta, seeking to recreate himself in the image of kings and emperors, realized the symbolic value of the nef and commissioned this wonderful neoclassical vessel from the Paris goldsmith Odio. It is to Germany, however, that I want to turn to last, for it's here that the tradition was strongest, certainly up to the 17th century. Perhaps the most remarkable survival of all is the Schlüsselfelder nef, which was made in about 1505 in Nuremberg and stands over 1 meter high. That is, like that. It's a tour de force. It's supported by a mermaid, rather like the Burley nef, and it has a great dragon as its prow. The rigging and almost every square centimeter of the ship is swarming with figures, and you can see this very well in this detail of the main deck, where you've got figures running around, you've got barrels of wine sitting on the deck, you even seem to have an altercation going on just in front of the steps between a couple of the crew members. It's an extraordinary, lively scene. Unbelievable though it may seem, like the Regensburg nef we saw earlier, this too was intended, in a sense, as a drinking vessel, or so we are to understand from an inscription that appears on an early drawing of the nef. I'm sorry I don't have a colour slide of this, which says, and I've blown up the inscription that you can see towards the bottom left, it says in German that the silver gilt ship weighs 26 marks, And when you remove the upper part, the lower section becomes a drinking vessel that holds 2 measures of drink. Given the thing is 1 meter high, one wonders really how one was supposed to feel after having consumed 1 of these measures of drink. Sadly, many of the most wonderful examples of the genre have not survived, and I show you one of great beauty that we know only from an illustrated inventory of the early 16th century. Barely recognizable as a ship, its mast has become a figure of Fortuna on a high pedestal, and its hull is a gallery of carved cameos. The Neff was originally part of the collection of Cardinal Albrecht of Brandenburg, one of the great princes of the church at the time of the Reformation. It was almost certainly made by an outstanding Nuremberg goldsmith called Ludwig Krug, whose surviving masterpiece, a cup in the treasury of Padua Cathedral, has an obvious family likeness to the Neff. And there it is. The same sorts of cameos, the same sort of goldsmith work, foliage that you see at the base of the bowl of the cup and around the foot of the cup. You can also see around the base of the depiction in the inventory. This inventory, incidentally, is really an extraordinary document, because the depictions of the objects, which are also accompanied by a very full description in writing, but the depictions of them are unbelievably fastidious and lifelike. We know that because 1 or 2 of the objects in the inventory do survive to this day, and comparing the real object with the drawing in the inventory, it is absolutely precise in its depiction. So we can have no doubt that this is a very, very accurate representation of the Neff that sadly disappeared, like so many others of the great masterpieces of medieval and Renaissance goldsmith work. The Neffs that survive in the greatest numbers are those made not for kings and cardinals, but for a much more, as it were, middle-class market. And they're much less sumptuous things. By and large, they were table decorations combined with drinking toys, and they were made in many shapes and sizes. Quite how diverse they could be is shown by this photograph from a recent exhibition of a collection formed, you won't be surprised to learn, by the German owner of a shipping company. This image gives a pretty good idea of the range of shapes and sizes that one finds. And one of the most impressive is in a private collection in Los Angeles that I have recently published, and that stands from foot to top, more than 50 centimeters high. It's by a goldsmith called Esaias van Linden of Nuremberg, who specialized in this sort of object, and like many of the others, it has a busy superstructure that can be lifted off to reveal a handy drinking vessel. Take off the top with the poop deck and the mast and the sails, and you get this. The ship owner that I just mentioned was not the first collector to major on this theme, and the catalogue of an English collection published as long ago as 1860, one of the first catalogues of a silver collection, incidentally, ever to have been published, includes a rather similar fleet of German Neffs. This collection was formed by one Lord Lonsborough, and mention of him brings me to the last, and I hope for you anyway, the most interesting part of this talk. For the frontispiece of his catalogue was yet another vessel of the same kind, though rather grander and more distinctive than the others. Unlike any of the others, it's formed as a galley rather than a sailing ship, and it had, as you can see from its caption, a direct connection with Malta. The Neff survives to this day, and like the Burley Neff, it is in extraordinary condition. There it is. But almost as interesting as the object itself is its swashbuckling history. Let me start with the later part of that history. As its name implies, the Neff was here in Malta, and the story, as told in Lonsborough's catalogue, is that it was part of the treasury of the knights until it was looted by Napoleon in 1798. At that time, along with the rest of the knights' treasures, it was stowed on board a vessel bound for France. But this particular ship was intercepted and captured by an English frigate, whose captain took the Neff as his share of the loot. After his death, it was sold to Lord Lonsborough. It then passed through several more owners before it was acquired in 1919 by, in fact, my great-grandfather. That part of the story is almost certainly accurate, but the earlier tradition, quoted in the Lonsborough catalogue, that it was a gift from the King of France to the knights, is probably not. The real early history of the Neff seems to be connected with this, the devastation surrounding the great siege of Malta in 1565. Now, I hardly need tell you about this ghastly episode in your island's history. The arrival of a huge Ottoman fleet, their establishment of a bridgehead on the island, the heroic efforts of Grand Master Jean de Valette and his fellow defenders, and the relief force eventually unreluctantly mounted by the European powers. Although the siege lasted, altogether the siege lasted about 6 months, and the defenders were all but wiped out. You know all this. So, one imagines, were the resources of the knight's treasury. And, if I might digress a moment, I thought you would like to know, if you don't already, that the St. John Museum in London, which the Silver Society visited only the other day, has recently acquired a wonderful silver and ormolu bust of your great hero, Valette, attributed to the sculptor Leon Leoni. The rebuilding of the treasury, one imagines, must have been a low priority compared with the repairing of the structural damage, particularly the defences of the island. But we know it was gradually replenished, and many of the new items must have come by way of gift. Such, I would like to suggest, was the origin of this Neff. The pennant at the top of the mast is engraved with a coat of arms. This has no colours, but it shows the cross of the order quartering another. Long ago, these arms were identified as those of Luis Mendez de Vasconcelos, who was Grand Master in the early 1620s. There are his arms. But I don't believe that can be right. In the first place, he was Grand Master long after the Neff was made, and the engraving on the flag looks contemporary to my eye with that on the ship. Secondly, the arms are clearly not the same as Vasconcelos's, whose shield has three bars rather than two. I would suggest instead that they are the arms of Philip Flach von Schwarzenberg. There are his arms. He was Grand Prior of the Order in the German lands and held office between 1573 and 1594. Flach von Schwarzenberg lived at Heitersheim, which is close to the Rhine and about 50 kilometers south of Strasbourg, which is where the Neff was made. This provenance is not yet proven, not yet, I stress. But I'm told that it would have been improper for a grand prior to quarter the arms of the order with his own. But people did not always obey the rules in heraldry, especially if they were in another country. And the fact that the Neff was made in Strasbourg seems to me to lend weight to the argument. You see here, these are the arms of Flach von Schwarzenberg on the left-hand side, and they have, as do the arms on the flag, they have two bars of, shall we say, because we have no tinctures, a lighter colour on a darker. So much for the heraldry and the provenance. But when we turn to the ship, things get really interesting. As a ship model, it is in some ways very accurate. In general design, it compares quite closely with actual Mediterranean galleys. This engraving shows an engagement between Maltese and Ottoman galleys, and you can see the same shaped hull, the same pointed prow, the same kind of awning over the poop. The same message comes across from this early 17th century painting of a Spanish galley. But there are some pretty obvious differences too. The first is that the silver galley is way too short. The Neff has only 6 oars on each side, whereas real galleys had more, sometimes many more. The other glaring difference is that there's something quite wrong with the sail. Triangular sails were usual on galleys, but arranged like that, it probably wouldn't work. And most contemporary images show them rigged quite differently, with the crossbar on a diagonal or a slant, such as you can see in this 17th century painting of a Maltese vessel. The most likely explanation for this, I believe, is that the sail, which is only attached by little wire rigging, came at some stage adrift and had to be reattached by a restorer who knew not so much about the appearance of Maltese galleys. Perhaps it could be adjusted at some future stage. I don't know. It's an interesting issue to look into. The engraving of the mermen and the sea monsters on the hull is obviously a goldsmith's embellishment, and it shows some of the fashionable, it follows some of the fashionable decorative prints of the time. But when one examines the deck, it takes on an extraordinary realism. The soldiers and their weapons are very accurately depicted, and the oarsmen are shown as a mixture of Christians and turbaned Turks. Here we see them down in the rowing department. This is, of course, quite right, and it reflects the fact that galley crews on both sides of the Christian-Ottoman divide were often made up of enslaved prisoners. And the goings-on on the poop deck are particularly intriguing. Here are the toffs. They're eating and drinking well. But look more closely still. This is half as closely as I want you to look. It shows them with a very realistic dining table of the period. There are plates, there are drinking vessels, silver drinking vessels. The food in the center is meat, meat, meat. Certainly no sign of any veg. And of course, there are knives on the table. You can see them quite clearly, but no forks. Forks did not come into general use until well into the 17th century. But look further in still, and we see that not only are they finely dressed, but they're actually wearing chains with the Order of St. John. A finer and more bespoke commission could hardly be imagined. One final detail of the story you will not by now be surprised to hear. Indeed, I'm sure you'd be disappointed not to hear. And that is that this Neff, like so many others, can, in theory, be used as a drinking vessel. The pointed prow of the boat can be unscrewed to reveal a tube that extends down to the bottom of the hull and that could, I repeat, in theory, be used to suck up the wine that had been poured through a small hole in the deck. Unlike the more practical Nuremberg and Regensburg Neffs that we looked at earlier, there's no way to separate the lower and upper parts of the Knights of Malta Neff. So I imagine it was not, in fact, normally used for drinking with at the Knights' banquets. there is much research still to be done on this remarkable object, and I've no doubt that a full explanation for all the different facets of its history could fill a book rather than a lecture. But perhaps this is enough for one evening. Well, we've come on a long voyage in this short talk, from the Ile de France via the metropolis of Nuremberg to the Isle of Malta. And from the 14th century via the late 16th to the 19th century. But I hope that this exploration of the fascinating phenomenon of the Princely Nef will help set the context for the three delightful 19th century vessels in the Palazzo Falzon. And now comes for the most difficult part of my lecture, and the one I am most likely to make a fool of myself on. Grazie milalb, u nitama li chatu gost, bedin it tahadita atira.
Really wonderful lecture. I can't say how thrilled I am to finally set my eyes on the Maltese Nef. I've been chasing it for a long time and finally it's turned up. Most of what you said about the Nef is absolutely spot on. There's a lot of documentation about it in the Maltese archives. The story goes, if I can take just a couple of minutes of your time, that it was one of the objects handpicked by Napoleon to send to France. Napoleon looted a lot, but mostly for melting. But he did pick up a few objects, the Jimenez cannon, which is now in the collections in London. He picked up a wonderful Chinese silk embroidered tablecloth. He picked up a few paintings showing Malta. And he picked up what in the records is described as a silver-gilt galley representing the Carrack of St. Anne, which is the second Carrack of the order. These were chosen by Napoleon and put on the Sensible. The Sensible was one of the frigates of Napoleon's fleet. And this left Malta quite close to Sicily. It was intercepted by the British man of war, the Seahorse, and was captured. All the items were taken on board the Seahorse and taken to London. The Jimenez cannon and the flags of the order were set apart. All the other objects were sold by auction for prize money. And so that is how it came into the market. And that's where I lost it and where you found it. But another thing is that all the other objects are lost except the Jimenez cannon, beautiful, probably one of the most beautiful cannons we had in Malta, a small exhibition piece, and the flags. The flags, unfortunately, took fire when the Tower of London, they were displayed in the Tower of London, and most of them were destroyed by fire. So now there is only the Nef. Second point, you're perfectly right, that is not the flag of the Grand Master. Although only the Grand Masters were entitled to quarter their personal coat of arms with the cross of the order, there was one special exception for the Grand Knights of the German Lung. The Knights of the German Lung were the only people who were exempted from this monopoly of the Grand Master, and they were allowed to quarter their arms also with the... So thank you very much. It's a very exciting discovery.
Well, if I... If I may reply to that, thank you very much indeed. Clearly there is a further conversation to have on this subject, which I would love to engage with you on at some stage. Would you tell me the sword of Grandmaster Jean de Valette, the copy of which we saw yesterday in the museum, and the original of which I believe Sandro told us is in the Louvre. Was that also one of the objects that Napoleon identified for his special interest?
Those were the sword and the dagger were also handpicked by Napoleon, but he took them with him to Egypt.
Ah.
The others he sent by the Saint-Cybele.
Yes.
But those two objects in particular, and all the bullion and all the melted silver and gold, that he took to Egypt with him.
Thank you.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you.